Across the country this election year, great political machines and many millions of dollars are bent on changing minds, your mind, to be specific. The arsenals of persuasion include inspirational messages, attacks, personal appeals, and vast armies of facts. And now the campaign consultants might want to add one more tool to their inventories, a new book on psychology. It's called Changing Minds by Howard Gardner, the influential Harvard psychologist best known for his theory of multiple intelligences. In his new book, Gardner examines how politicians, creative artists, business leaders, teachers, and prospective dates go about the business of changing deeply held opinions, what works, what doesn't, and why. Toward the end of the hour, we'll celebrate the 30th anniversary of an event that changed records and possibly a few minds, Hank Aaron's 715th home run, and we'll talk with the new Pulitzer Prize winner for criticism, who's got a few critics of his own. But now you're invited to join the conversation. Who has convinced you to change your mind on an important point? How did they do it? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Howard Gardner. He's on the campus of Harvard University. He's with us to discuss the art and science of changing minds. It's great to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much, Neil.
As I just mentioned, the devices of mind-changing are of particular interest to politicians whose business, as you point out, is to move opinion. You use an interesting example for this point, former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
I wanted to choose somebody where there was already a historical record, so it wouldn't be quite as controversial as if I were to choose Bill Clinton or George Bush. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that in the last 50 years, if you think about democratic societies, the person who brought about the biggest change in the way that his or her country thought was, in fact, Margaret Thatcher. And very briefly, after the Second World War, there was kind of a consensus among the Tories and the Labors that Britain should be content to be a kind of a second-string nation with moderate degree of socialism, powerful unions, nationalized industries, and that was just fine. And this didn't sit at all well with Margaret Thatcher. She was a real old-fashioned British patriot. She believed in enterprise. She believed in people should be rewarded for hard work. She didn't like unions. She didn't like nationalized industries. And when she ran for the position of prime minister in 1979, she said, "Britain is not working." And she made that point over and over again, and she actually believed she was the only person who could get it to work. And the strength of her achievement is best exemplified by the fact that even though she's been out of office for 15 years, people still debate very much what was good and bad about her legacy. Tony Blair came in on the blanket of a third way, somewhere in between the socialism of the post-Second World War period and Margaret Thatcher's muscular free market. And that's what I would call somebody having real political influence, certainly on the level of Ronald Reagan, who actually came after Thatcher and learned a lot from her.
And how, it's interesting also your analysis of how she went about it.
Not only did she tell what I call a very effective story, the story which I just summarized briefly, mm-hmm. that Britain was going in one direction, it was the wrong direction, she saw the right direction, and she could help Britain achieve grandeur and make people free to realize and achieve whatever they were capable of, but she embodied it in her own life. This just wasn't something that was created by a spin doctor. I don't even know if we had the notion of spin doctor in those days.
Oh, yes, we did.
She was somebody who came from an impoverished background. Her father was a grocer. She was raised in the apartment above the grocery store. She had her work to get not one but two degrees, one in chemistry, one in law. She raised her kids before going into political life, and people said she really walked the talk. This makes sense, and this woman embodies this story. Also, I used her because she, in fact, exemplifies what I call the seven levers of mind-changing better than most other examples that I could think of.
Well, tell us a little bit more about these seven levers. And it, by the way, if your profession is political consultant, you might want to have these tattooed on your forearm. But go ahead.
I have to mention that about a month ago before the book came out, my publisher actually got a phone call from Ralph Nader's office asking for an advance copy of the book. And my kid said, only if you can convince him to change his mind and not having him run. But that hasn't happened yet. Typically, the man or woman in the street focuses on what I call rewards and resources. Namely, if you give people enough rewards, they'll change their minds. And there's no question that most of us have a bribable level. The problem is that that changes behavior rather than changing minds. And when the rewards disappear, so typically does the behavior. People like me who are academics are very much influenced by what I call reason, how good the argument is, and research, how good people are at providing supportive data. Margaret Thatcher was a very good arguer. She loved the debates in the House of Commons on Thursdays, where she had to hold her own against various opponents from the Labour Party. She was a fiend for statistics, devoured them. Like most arguers, she knew how to use them in her favor, but nobody would catch her without a numerical or factual answer to a question that was raised. But in addition, she used other levers which aren't recognized as much. One which one doesn't have that much control over, but one tries to make the best use of, is what I call real-world events. Margaret Thatcher didn't cause an oil crisis in 1979. She certainly didn't cause the Falkland War in 1982 or the Party Congress bombing, where she almost was killed in Brighton.
At Brighton, yeah.
Right. But in each of these cases, she was equal to the event. She was able to make use of it. And that's a very important and, I think, underestimated lever of mind changing, is knowing what's going on in the world and being able to use it to your advantage. She used what I call representational redescription. That's a rather technical way of saying making her point in lots of different ways. She talked well. She had good stories. But she also embodied them in the way that she behaved. She made good use of cartoons. There was a famous cartoon of an unemployment line saying Britain is not working. She surrounded herself by people who were admired captains of industry, as if to say this is what's available to everybody if they were simply work hard. So it isn't an effective mind changer. Doesn't just repeat the same message over and over again, though, alas, that's necessary. But an effective mind changer uses as many different symbol systems, in my terms, as many different intelligences as possible. And Margaret Thatcher was very good at activating lots of different mental representations, as we say. Mm-hmm. She also resonated with people. They may not have loved her personally, but they somehow felt that she meant it. This was a genuine person. She, in fact, felt that British people and she were on the same kind of wavelength. And I think for most of her career, that was correct. In fact, I think that she eventually was pushed out of office precisely because, like many people who've been powerful for a long time, she stopped paying attention to what other people were saying, and that was her downfall. The final one, which I think most people in every sphere, whether it's politics, business, academics, the professions, families, I talk about all of these kind of mind changings, that we all underestimate is being able to know the resistance to your ideas and being able to realize how deep the opposition can be and how, in a sense, you never finally win something. There's a quotation from Margaret Thatcher where she talks about all the things that she spent her life trying to achieve: orthodox finance, low taxation, minimal bureaucracy, etc. She says, "I did not believe I had to open windows into men's souls on these matters. The arguments for them seem to have been won. I now know that such arguments are never finally won." If you want to be a mind changer, if your name is George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, John Kerry, Bob Kerry, you have to realize that you can never let your guard down. The old neural networks are still there, ready to be activated, unless you can pinpoint the areas of resistance. And actually, the best people for doing that are people who themselves had a resistance and conquered it.
Converts.
I don't know whether Margaret Thatcher was ever a labor right. I doubt it. But I think that she did have a conversion when she read during the Second World War Frederick Hayek's book about the road to serfdom.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was one of the things where she knew what the arguments against her position were, and so she could grappled with them in a way that people who'd never been touched by an alternative point of view would have a lot of difficulty doing.
And if that answer is too long to tattoo on your forearm, you should know that there's a concise version of these seven factors on the Talk of the Nation portion of the NPR website. Just go to our page at www.npr.org. And we're going to take some calls now with Howard Gardner. His new book is Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to begin with Lisa, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I called because when I was in law school, I read a book that changed my mind about sort of my philosophy in terms of just life, and that was Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged. Yes, because I had what most Americans would describe as liberal thoughts about how the government should run, how things should operate, and what Ayn Rand's book does, of course, is they take them in a fictional setting in a novel. Illustrate how she feels they would play out in real life and convince me.
It's interesting, Howard Gardner, you talk about to people who try to change people's minds directly, like politicians, but also people who are artists. I'm not sure Ayn Rand fits quite into that category, but her book certainly changed Lisa's mind.
Yes, in fact, it's about an architect, as I recall. So there's a double kind of artistry there. Absolutely. I'm convinced that mind-changing of equal or even greater significance occurs by people who most of us never see or hear directly, and those are creators, people who produce a work of art, a scientific formula, a theory, and often the change doesn't take place right away, but over time it can really bring about what we call a paradigm change. And there's no question that the writings of Ayn Rand had that effect on many, many people, not least Alan Greenspan, who for many years was a dyed-in-the-wool convert to an Ayn Randian position. I'd like to ask Lisa, though, do you think it was partly the timing in your life? Do you think that if you'd read it 10 years before, you would have been pretty young then, or 10 years later, it would have had the same effect? Or do you think it was kind of you were going in a certain direction and you hit this book and somehow things gelled?
I'm not sure if I was going in that direction, although I certainly was in my second year of law school, where you're learning about the foundations of the law, and then so you're kind of questioning everything and relearning a lot of things that you had always assumed. But I think what really impressed me about her book is that she's writing actually about creators. She's writing about people who she feels move society along, and she just takes this radical idea of them all striking. And I guess it going to school with people who were about to go out into the workforce, many of them like me for the first time, it just struck me, what if none of us did that? What if everyone who makes things or manufactures things or create, you know, architects or whoever, just went on strike and didn't share their ideas with the world anymore? It's just really intriguing.
So. Yeah, she's an idealist. And I think young people are particularly susceptible to individuals who portray society in a very different kind of way than they've been accustomed to having it when they were young. What typically happens, though, Lisa, is that people end up regressing and being less Randian as they get older. That's happened to Alan Greenspan. How about in your case?
Not yet.
Okay, well, great. Stick to your guns.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Indeed, a lot of your book is about the more malleable mind of children and young people. But also, it's interesting you say that, I'm not sure we're going to have time for the whole answer to this question in what we have remaining in this segment, but that a lot of children's ideas are very difficult to change.
Yes, while kids' minds change on some things with little effort from anybody, already by the age of 4 or 5, they develop very powerful theories about the world, and those are the things that are hard to change, even when we teach them that directly. Evolution is a very good example. Almost all 7 or 8-year-olds believe the world was created at one time and things never change. They are creationists. And even if they live in a home of Darwinians, they still have that belief. And nowadays in America, still 80% of people feel that way, even though you find almost no biologist who doesn't believe in evolution. And that same thing applies whether you're talking about economics, history, mathematics, physics. The ideas that we form when we're very young are very, very robust. And I think the best way to change them is through this representational redescription, where you attack the old idea in all sorts of ways until it finally wobbles and collapses.
Howard Gardner is talking about his new book on the art and science of changing minds. Who's changed your mind, and how did they do it? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the psychological process of changing your mind or changing other people's minds with Harvard professor Howard Gardner. You're invited to join us. What factors do you find most important in changing your mind? What's your best strategy for persuading others? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN, at NPR.org. And Howard Gardner is with us from Harvard University. And when you talk about those neural pathways, what's going on in the brain when you're trying to change someone's mind?
When we're very young, we develop certain ideas, often without much help from any kind of formal tuition. And when we talk about neural networks, I'm actually speaking quite explicitly about patterns which we find it easier to go down the longer we've had those ideas. So essentially what you say is that you're building resistances to anything new. And the notion that a single experience can wipe out those pathways that have been there for many years is appealing in a artistic sense.
St. Paul on the road to Damascus.
Absolutely. But all the evidence suggests that very rarely does this happen. Instead, what happens much more typically is that there are various challenges to these ideas which come up and they chip away at, we might say, a very powerful engraving. And if somebody's watching you very carefully, they can often see that you're beginning to wobble. But at a certain point, it erupts into consciousness. And that's the point at which you say, gee, my mind has changed, but somebody who watches you carefully might not be nearly so surprised as you are. I think the best witnesses there are therapists who listen very carefully to pauses, to slips, and these are clues that a person's view of himself or the world or his mother or whatever is beginning to change, but it could take weeks or even months before the person says, you know, I never realized it before, but I'm treating my boss just the way I treated my own father. Mm-hmm. And boy, I really have to rethink these kinds of things. An interesting discovery in the process of this book was the nature of fundamentalism. Most of us think of fundamentalism in relationship to religion. But I realized after doing my study that, in fact, we have fundamentalism in every sphere, from business to politics to science. Fundamentalism are ideas which we're so committed to that we say under no circumstances will we change our minds about this. I'm a fundamentalist when it comes to science. Any issue which is susceptible to research and to experiment, I feel you should do that and not just stick to an idea if the data go against that. You can be a fundamentalist in the area of business if, for example, you say the way Sumner Redstone, who is a very successful media owner, says, content is king. That means it doesn't matter whether you're sending it by radio or internet or so on. It's the content that's important. If you are coming in a fundamentalist family, the real challenge to fundamentalism is adolescence. About half the people who start out as fundamentalists leave during the time of adolescence. But if you can keep that neural network protected during adolescence, when for the first time kids begin to think about the world as being different from the way it could be, then you're set for life. It's interesting, the two examples we heard earlier, Margaret Thatcher reading the von Hayek book about the road to serfdom, and Lisa the telephoner who spoke about Fountainhead and the book of Ayn Rand. In both cases, you have people there who were in college and who were open enough to take a look at another kind of idea, one that was different from theirs. And in both of those cases, they stuck with the idea over a long period of time. That's exceptional. Many people, as Churchill said, are open up to a different political view when they're 20, but the time the age of 40, they or we regress to earlier views. And that's because those neural networks haven't been really unsettled. Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher of science, pointed out that older scientists almost never buy the new paradigm. That is, people who were 50 in Einstein's time never became Einsteinians. And Einstein, when he was 50, never became a quantum mechanical. Instead, as Kuhn points out, you have to wait for the younger generation because they are open to a new kind of idea. So that's a long answer, but yeah. I hope it gives a sense of the obstacles against mind change and, we might say, the best times at which to do it. As for the levers, I think of them as being arrows in a quiver. And everybody's got these seven arrows, research, resonance, et cetera, and you could choose them randomly or you could try to use everyone in order. I think the real art in mind changing is I want to change this patient's mind or my children's mind or I'm the leader of a company, I want to change the employee's mind, what's the best arrow to use first? And if that doesn't work, which one should I turn to next?
Well, let's get another caller on the line. And this is Chris, who's with us from Hillsborough, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Dr. Gardner. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming at this interesting topic with a background in religious studies. And to my ear, I like the emphasis that you're putting on the neural network and bringing neurobiology into basically what the ancients would have called rhetoric. But it sounds to me like you're casting human beings as awfully rational animals, that you're suggesting that what changes the way people think are primarily ideas and their presentation. And I hear David Hume rolling over in his grave and saying, no, 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 reason is the slave of desire. And I also think about what some scholars in new religious movements have shown, that the way that religious movements, to go back to your fundamentalism's analogy, the way that they draw and attract new adherents is through the expansion of social networks. That I want to suggest that what changes our mind to maybe a greater extent than I've heard in your presentation is the people that we're around and the social networks that we are and are becoming part of.
I think that's an excellent critique. I would just want to say that it's a better critique of the way I tend to present my own ideas than it is of the book Changing Minds. Because, as I said earlier, I think academics tend to focus on reason and research.
Sure.
To put it to be cynical about it, that's how we get tenure. But I think it's the other levers. You talk about desire. That's awfully close to what I mean when I talk about rewards and resources.
Uh-huh.
Who can give me something that I need? Resonance, what feels right. I absolutely agree. The data show that what gets people to switch religions or to become more religious is to find a group with which they feel very comfortable. And to me, resonance is the most mysterious of all the properties. It has to do with what's likable and what feels good to you. Let's just take presidential candidates. Many people are much more impressed intellectually with Al Gore or with John Kerry than they are with George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But few can deny that for many, many people, perhaps a majority, they feel more compatible with George Bush. They resonate better to him. He feels like one of them, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say he was blessed with the likable gene or with people who can make him very, very likable. I wasn't able to see the Condoleezza Rice testimony today. I did hear some of it on the radio. I'm sure there were people like me who would be interested in the arguments, but I bet you most people were making judgments about resonance. Do I feel comfortable with this person? Was she trying to do the right thing? When she got into a shouting match with Benveniste, was he bullying her the way he bullied people during the Watergate hearings, or was she, in fact, not even giving them a chance to ask the question because she was defensive and so on? They were making a judgment on that particular basis. So I think the book puts rationality in its place, but maybe it's harder to put me in my place.
Well, no, that's a terrific response, and I look forward to reading your book. It sounds very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Chris.
Uh-huh.
Let's go now to Jace, and Jace is on the line from Rochester, New York.
Hi, Neil. I really enjoy your show, I have to say.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I had an interest, just a comment about some of my experience in convincing people that often I find the more effective way of convincing someone, especially if it's someone who, as you were saying, thinks kind of logically about things, or sometimes people who are kind of less firm in their beliefs, is often to just kind of float the idea or float the argument, kind of present it briefly, and then allow the person to kind of convince themselves through their own, over a period of time, kind of over a long period of time, and that sometimes it's actually not possible to convince someone or to change someone's mind in a short period of time, but that it requires a long period of time over which this person can adapt their views. And I was just curious as to kind of what you thought about the different time scales required to change minds.
I think your point's a very apt one. I would add to that one of the traps we fall into is we use the story that we're comfortable with rather than a story which will open people's mind to think about things in different kind of ways. So when you talk about floating the idea, one of the things to do is to see which of the various garbs in which you dress the idea seems to intrigue the person, and that's the way to continue to do it in the future. I have some discussions in the book of mind-changing efforts which don't work, and typically they don't work when a person assumes that the story that he or she believes in or the way that he or she argues or resonates or fulfills the desire is the way the other person does. So the more you can let the other person present himself or herself, the better the evidence that you'll be able to be effective. When we talk about someone like Bill Clinton as having political genius, it's in part because a man like that can go into a room with disparate people and read their reactions such that what he says and how he says it alienates the fewest number and converts the largest number. In contrast, both Hillary Clinton and Newt Gingrich are terrific at speaking to the converted, but are not very good at putting a different frame which might get somebody to change their mind about a topic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That agrees with a lot of my experience. It sounds like a really interesting book, and I look forward to reading it.
Okay, Jake. So
thanks, Jason.
Thanks for the call. Let's go now to Brian in Columbus, Ohio.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
My comment sort of brings together the previous two callers, the first one talking about the less rational and the second one talking about long-term process. I have found that as an openly gay person, the best way I have of changing people's minds is the least argumentative, which is simply being me. And that seems to carry a lot more work. And it ties back into the comment about fundamentalists. And I think your speaker's last comments really, to me, more emphasizes what identify the fundamentalists, which is they argue from their position as if without being open to anything else, because by definition, that's what they believe to be the truth, and therefore they're not defending it, they're not arguing it, they're simply continually restating it, because they think you're too stupid to comprehend it. And well, that seems to be the definition of fundamentalism. Or the expression of fundamentalism, perhaps.
Howard, is Brian embodying his story?
Your comment connects with a letter of the editor I read just today where somebody said how they were converted from being anti-gay, and that was having a son who's gay. And I think what you're saying is the more somebody gets to know you as a human being and has you as rather than as a member of a category, the higher the possibility when the category emerges that
exactly.
The person will change their mind. But it's not something one can count on. I mean, if somebody is raised as an anti any kind of thing, it's the exception rather than the rule for one person to change their mind. It's sort of the famous saying, you know, some of my best friends are Jews, which means I'm still not going to like Jews, but I'll make an exception in your
right.
case.
Absolutely. And nothing's guaranteed. I mean, I'm not saying this is the magic formula, and I'm sure that you don't hold out any one pattern or behavior or procedure as the magic formula.
Yes, it's very interesting if you read... Yeah, if you read about changes that have taken place in American society over the last 50 years, there definitely has been a change in thinking about race and about gender. We are now in the midst of the change taking place about gays, particularly with reference to the institution of marriage. I can't believe that in 50 years people will kind of laugh at the arguments we're having now, but it may take 50 years. Changing minds when it comes to something that people have had long histories with biblical support for one way is not something that even a good argument or a wonderful person like you are, I assume, Brian, will do it.
Brian, thanks for the call.
Great. Thanks so much.
We're speaking with Howard Gardner. His new book is Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's hear now from Darren, who's on the line from Pocatello, Idaho.
Hi, it's nice to be with you, Neil, Dr. Gardner.
Thanks.
I just had a question. I'm a doctoral student, and I'm looking to do a dissertation actually on the ethics of persuasion in regards to public address, like bureaucrats and that. What's the line between persuasion and propaganda? What's the ethical parameter?
When I wear the hat as a social scientist, I'm trying to describe the way things are. So when I talk about different kinds of intelligence, I know that both Nelson Mandela and Slobodan Milosevic have a lot of interpersonal intelligence. They use it in very different kinds of ways. When I write a book about changing minds, I know that some people will try to use it for reasons which are perverse, and as a scholar, I can't affect that. As a human being, as a citizen, I have very strong views about how things ought to be done. The very last section of Changing Minds is called Goodware, and it's my own arguments about how we should be able to get people to change minds in ways which are constructive, which are life-affirming, which broaden our community rather than narrowing it, which give hope to life survival Neil referred to Gandhi notions of conflict without people killing one another. But when I say that, I have to say I'm saying that as a citizen and not as a scholar. I believe very much in openness, in transparency. People often say to me, well, you know, a lot of people supported Hitler, and Hitler said what he was trying to do when he wrote Mein Kampf. But Heinrich Himmler, who was Hitler's henchman, said of the Holocaust, this is the greatest thing that human beings have ever done, which human beings cannot know about. And it's casting the light on things which makes the big difference. That's why it was so important for Condoleezza Rice today to testify openly and under oath, because it gives us a chance to see whether the rumors we've heard are true and makes her accountable for it. And in that sense, I'm a believer in democracy, civil liberties, and a media which calls the things the way they are rather than one that's controlled by forces which are trying to push a particular agenda.
That help you out with your dissertation, Darren?
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. In fact, actually, your last comment on the media is where I'm focusing on programs like Talk of the Nation and other talk radio on the ethics of media particularly, and those who are trying to persuade and educate, and those that are perhaps trying to propagate. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I look forward to reading the book.
Great. And I have to make one point here. I think that talk radio is a fascinating phenomenon of mind-changing, because on the one hand, you have people like Rush Limbaugh on the right or Al Franken on the left, who probably are chiefly speaking to those who are already converted. But something like NPR, which I listen to very, very regularly, you actually might change your mind about something because you hear the discussion of both sides of an issue, and you can even feel it inside yourself if you don't have strong feelings, say, about social promotion, and you hear it in schools, and you hear it 10 minutes on that. It's actually an exercise of changing minds. So the few institutions we have, the few newspapers, TV channels, and radios, which aren't simply either pushing commercial elements or pushing one political point of view, are very precious. And I would say this even if I wasn't appearing in Talk of the Nation.
Well, whether that mind changes for good or ill, we'll have to leave up to the listeners to decide. But interestingly, media, we just have a few seconds left in the segment. You write about Jay Winston, who designed a campaign, the designated driver campaign, and did an interesting technique.
Yes, Jay Winston said, look, there are countries in Europe like Sweden where people routinely decide in the beginning of the evening who should be the driver, and that person doesn't drink. How can we get Americans to believe in this? And he made contact with, I think, 150 different television producers and got them to agree to include as a natural part of a drama show or a comedy show the designated driver idea. And I think this was a brilliant move on his part, because rather than the public service announcement where we know, well, somebody is being asked to do this, instead we're doing something as part of a natural scenario. And this designated driver campaign, from all reports, was very, very successful. We all know about the difference between public service announcements and smoking, where you say don't smoke, and then movies or TV shows where you see people smoking and they're very attractive figures and they're having a wonderful time. And it's that kind of tension which I think you have to
resolve.
Use the powers of the media to combat.
We'll have more with Howard Gardner after a short break, and we'll also talk with the man who came home on 7:15. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're wrapping up our conversation with Howard Gardner. His new book is Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds, and he's with us from Harvard University. Here's an email we got from Molly Barman, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Rochester, New York. No one, he writes, can make me change my mind if it is against my will or inclination.
The question is whether it's worth trying, and I think the answer is, what are the stakes? If I'm a salesperson or I'm a politician, I have to decide that it's important in my interest to try to change your mind, and I have to make a certain number of forays. If those prove unsuccessful, then you are what I would call... Either I'm a poor mind changer, or you are what I would call a fundamentalist. Namely, you've simply made a commitment not to change your mind under any circumstances. That's a risky thing to do because it means that you are certain you're right. And if you've had to deal with people who you disagree with and they're certain they're right, I imagine you find that that's an unpleasant situation.
Let's get a caller on the line. And this is, we'll go with Francis, who's with us from Palo Alto, California.
Hi. You've touched on something that... you didn't initially, that I think is extremely significant, which is the difference between changing a mind and changing a worldview. And I don't know if you deal with that in your book, but when you talk about a person changing their mind and then slowly going back to what they initially believed, I think it's because they've only changed their mind, the idea, without changing their worldview. My life-changing experience was Vatican II in the early 60s, and out of that, I became an open, liberal person, not in need of a set of beliefs and not in need of a sense of fundamentalism. I can change, and I hope that that worldview of being able to change is not something I lose just because I'm old.
I think that probably rather than being the changing your mind versus changing your worldview, it makes more sense to think of a whole set of continua ranged from things as banal as I'm going to eat lunch at 2 o'clock rather than 1 o'clock to, well, maybe we won't go on vacation this year, to, you know, I'm going to consider voting Republican for the first time, to saying, as our early callers said, you know, my life was really changed forever when I first was exposed to this political view, or in your case, when you first heard a religious view. Clearly, those fundamental life-changing worldviews are very rare. They're also very precious, and as you very sensitively point out, Francis, they're the things that are most important to us. You'll probably forget that you at one time ate lunch rather than two rather than one. You're certainly not going to forget your religious views when they were changed in a very fundamental way.
Listening to Condoleezza Rice today, to me the most significant thing she did was not recognize the importance within government of people interacting. When she kind of dismissed the notion of the principal's meeting because it's just a bunch of aides standing around the edge of the room. Well, you know what? Those aides standing around the edge of the room could have been the most important communication device available to us. And when she dismissed that, that tells me that in her worldview, unless something is structured, she won't value it. And I found that a greater concern than anything else she said.
I think that's an extremely sensitive observation. From the limited amount of knowledge I have of Condoleezza Rice, I think it's probably an accurate description. However, in fairness to her, I think it's probably an accurate description of very many people who ascend very quickly, very fast in public life. But that's the reason we want to see somebody on television or hear them on the radio in an unrehearsed situation, in interchange, because that's when those things leak out. And if you were trying to change people's minds about Condoleezza Rice and you were putting together a political campaign, that's the particular shot that you would put on. Just think about how many people's minds were changed about Howard Dean just because he had the misfortune of losing it for 10 seconds after the Iowa result. But that's what got shown everywhere. And so the media make very powerful decisions about what 10 seconds to play on the air. And those are the ones which they hope will actually change people's minds, not the ones that will simply reinforce situations. But I would imagine that only 1 out of 100 people, Francis, who heard that remark drew the inference that you did, namely, they are people who count and people who don't count.
We thank Francis for her call. And Howard Gardner, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Neil.
Howard Gardner is the author of Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Your Own and Other People's Minds. He's a professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he joined us today from the campus of Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.